This is the Tom Hartman Program on AirAmericaRadio.com.
Welcome to the Tom Hartman Program.
Tom Hartman.
Truth in Broadcasting.
And a happy New Year's, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. It is the day after New Year's Day, the beginning of the new year, and the day before the Iowa primaries. All kinds of stuff going on. Stuff flying around wild in all 16 different directions. We're going to be talking a little later on in the program with both Chris Dodd and Dennis Kucinich. And Kucinich today, and actually this is a conversation that I had with him on Monday, which was before the announcement today, he has come out and said that his caucus goers in Iowa, should they not get the 15% threshold necessary to stand in place, should go caucus with Mr. Obama. And I would love to get the thoughts of Ralph Nader on that. Ralph Nader, the guy that I voted for president in 2000, but not in 2004. And we've had this conversation before. Ralph Nader, Nader.org, his website. He's also, in addition to being a consumer advocate, a lawyer, and an icon of all that's good in America, in my opinion, he's also the author of a brilliant book, The 17 Traditions. Ralph Nader, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Happy New Year to you and your listeners.
Thank you, sir. You are not endorsing John Edwards, but throwing your support to him. Is there at least according to the Politico? You want to tell us about that?
Yeah, I mean, for years, I try to make the distinction with the people that there's such a thing as commenting favorably on a position or a statement by a political candidate without endorsing all 100 or 150 of that person's positions. But the press is very quick to take praise of the Edwards very important statement, which I think is probably the most insightful of his own campaign, which is, quote, "Do you really believe if we replace a bunch of corporate Republicans with a bunch of corporate Democrats that anything meaningful is going to change?" And I praise that. And I think that goes to the central issue of political campaign, which is about the proper distribution of power in America. Who has too much of it? The few. Who has too little? The many. And who makes the decisions? The few over the many. That's why I was a little disappointed to hear that Dennis Kucinich is urging his followers in Iowa to support Obama, who basically has been tiptoeing around the area of corporate domination of our political economy, elections, government, etc., the corporate crime wave, the taxpayer subsidies of corporate welfare, the distortion of the public budgets into military expenditures, now over half of the whole federal government's operating budget, and there's no more Soviet Union. I was really surprised because Dennis's views on the need to control corporate power and to subordinate corporate power to popular sovereignty, the sovereignty of the people, as our founders referred to it, is much closer to John Edwards than to Barack Obama.
Yeah, this I've been scratching my head ever since this came out. I first met Dennis Kucinich, I think, about 10 years ago when a mutual friend of ours, Marianne Williamson, was putting together the Renaissance Alliance. I was on the board for several years. We had a meeting in Washington, D.C. to talk about a Department of Peace. And I spoke at it about corporate power. I just had a book come out called Unequal Protection about the rise of corporate dominance in America. And I've always thought that Dennis Kucinich was a real progressive icon, and I'm baffled. Do you have any insights?
No, not at all.
Yeah, okay. Your support and non-endorsement of John Edwards, what does this mean for the possibility of a Ralph Nader candidacy?
Well, as I've said, I'll have to decide in a few weeks about whether I'm going to try to mobilize more grassroots support and extend the any campaign into 2009. I think campaigns for third parties should transcend the November election day and try to build a people's lobby to cycle back on Washington, especially on Congress. But I must say that the Fortune magazine piece last June on Hillary Clinton, where in effect they answered the question, why does big business love Hillary Clinton? gives many of us in the progressive area serious pause about what the future of the Democratic Party is going to be if she happens to win the nomination in the election, because she really has made her peace with big business and basically accepted the corporate status quo and corporate occupied territory in Washington. She does a few rhetorical flourishes once in a while against the drug and her insurance companies, but if you look at her record on the Senate Armed Services Committee, she's never met a giant weapon system she doesn't like, no matter how much these systems have been condemned as being strategically obsolete after the fall of the Soviet Union, and or unnecessary like the F-22, which is going to cost over $200 billion.
Mm-hmm. Michael Bloomberg. I'm curious whether you launch a third-party candidacy or not. Michael Bloomberg and presumably Chuck Hagel seem to be positioning themselves for this. What are your thoughts on that?
I think because the Republican camp is weak, apart from possibly McCain, who's a long odds to win the nomination, I think it's very likely that Bloomberg's going to get in. What's his downside? He can turn it into a three-way race. He doesn't have to make one call for money. He can get on the ballots in all the states. He's a well-known figure, and he'll be even more well-known. Mayor of the largest city in America, founder of a huge media empire from scratch in 1980. He's worth about $20 billion. He spends $1 to $2 billion, and he'll outspend everybody. And why wouldn't he want to get in? Senator Hagel is just aching to be his vice president. And I think he can say to himself that from the get-go, he'll be number two in the polls unless someone like McCain gets the Republican nomination.
Well, one of my best friends is a New Yorker and a Democrat, has been his whole life, and he likes Bloomberg. I know a number of Democrats in New York who think that Bloomberg has been a good mayor and kind of, you know, I mean, he used to be a Democrat, then he was a Republican, now he's an independent. To what extent would a Bloomberg candidacy hurt the Democratic candidate as opposed to the Republican candidate?
Right now it's too early to tell. It's clear, however, that he'll take from the Republican votes, he'll take from the Democrats votes, and he'll take a lot of independent votes. That's why I think he can position himself very well if he moves in. It'll also be a much more exciting race. It'll raise big issues about the Electoral College, about the third parties, about more voices and choices for the people, about paying attention to our cities, which are being relatively ignored by the present candidates in Iowa and New Hampshire, largely rural states. Now, I think, I don't agree with Bloomberg's policies in many areas. He is a champion of corporate welfare. He's given huge tax breaks to these giant brokerage firms in New York City who threaten to go across the river and position themselves in New Jersey. So he gives these big tax breaks to Merrill Lynch and others. And he's not very sensitive on civil liberties. You know, when you have a big political demonstration, it's peaceful in New York City. Mayor Bloomberg is not really that tough on police exuberance or misbehavior, and that worries a lot of civil libertarians.
I mean, one of the things that you've pointed out, and particularly in your support for John Edwards, is that the biggest issue of our day right now is corporate dominance of not just the political sphere, but basically everything. And, you know, corporations asserting that they can even own us. They can own our DNA. They can own our personal information. And how could we trust somebody who basically is a billionaire by virtue of the corporate form to be a champion of anti-corporate reform?
It's all very, very relative, Tom. In other words, people will look at Bloomberg and say, well, he's not owned by anyone because he owns so much, you know.
Right.
How do you buy a guy who's worth $20 billion?
That's what they said about Teddy Roosevelt and Franklin Roosevelt, too.
Yeah, and Perot, too, Ross
yeah.
Perot.
Yeah.
So that'll be good. The second is, I don't think he'll be awed by big business. That doesn't mean he won't go with them. It does mean that he might want to really crack down on corporate crime, fraud, and abuse with a good attorney general. He's because he is a big business guy, he's not awed by him. There are a lot of liberals who are really awed by big business. You know, they think, wow, look at these guys. They've met a big payroll you know, and they go around with all kinds of entourage and yachts and private jets. But you won't see that with Bloomberg. On the other hand, you know, he is part of the dominant corporate system. So we shouldn't be overwhelmed by these things, except that, you know, it'll be a more exciting race, more voices, more choices, more unpredictability. You'll get more votes out. You'll emphasize more of the independents. So, you know, it's better than just a two-party elected dictatorship trying to run itself for another 4 years.
Well, we definitely live in interesting times. Ralph Nader, Nader.org, the website. Check out his book, The 17 Traditions, too. Ralph Nader, thanks for being with us.
Thanks very much, Tom.
Good talking with you. 16 minutes past the hour.
Exposing the con in conservative. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Time to vote!
21 minutes past the hour. So welcome back. Oh, a lot going on out there. This, you know, I find this this very interesting. The outside groups spending heavily on this, and right after the break at the bottom of the hour, we will play an interview I did with Dennis Kucinich on Monday morning at 6:30 in the morning, in fact, my time. I probably wasn't in my best form, but nonetheless, at the time that I did that interview, I did not know that Chris Dodd was getting support from the International Association of Firefighters, apparently hundreds of thousands of dollars. They're out there in this giant black and gold bus going around speaking on his behalf. The John Edwards was getting support from the Service Employees International Union. They just kicked in $800,000. I did know that he was getting union support. I didn't know the specifics of it. And that's, this was all in an article in the New York Times, actually, on January 1st. And that Senator Hillary Rodham Clinton, which was the day after my interview, the Senator Hillary Rodham Clinton has gotten $770,000 worth of advertising promoting her candidacy from AFSCME, the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. And apparently, Barack Obama of Illinois is the only leading Democrat. I'm quoting here from the New York Times piece by Leslie Wayne. Senator Barack Obama of Illinois is the only leading Democrat who has not attracted support from any of these groups in Iowa. That would be the unions. And that would be the unions who Dennis Kucinich is attacking as special interest groups. But I'll let him speak for himself on that in a few minutes. In his... I'm not sure you'd call it endorsement. I don't think that Dennis Kucinich would call it that. Well, here's, you know, the story from his website, apparently. Democratic presidential candidate and Ohio Congressman Dennis Kucinich opened the new year by publicly asking his Iowa supporters to vote for him in the caucuses this Thursday and suggested that if he did not make the 15% threshold, their second ballot should be for Barack Obama. And he said, Obama and I have one thing in common, change. And, you know, I find that very interesting. One of the things they don't have in common is that three of Barack Obama's top political aides are registered lobbyists for dozens of corporations, including Walmart, British Petroleum, and Lockheed Martin. This according to an article in The Hill. While they received payments from his campaign, according to public documents, they were also being paid by these corporations. Z Magazine says Obama is receiving many millions of election dollars from the real special interest groups that most significantly control U.S. society, culture, politics, and policy. One day after Obama denounced big money control of U.S. politics in Iowa City, the Los Angeles Times reported that Obama raised more than $1 million, this is quoting from the Los Angeles Times, quote, raised more than $1 million in the first 3 months of his presidential campaign from law firms and companies that have major lobbying operations in the nation's capital, end of quote. And, you know, this goes on. Obama dances for Wall Street. This is from Z Magazine, again, which is a pretty progressive publication. ZMag.org is their website. Obama dances for Wall Street on the Social Security crisis, as Paul Krugman points out, and sounds like Mitt Romney and Rudy Giuliani in decrying the specter of government-mandated universal health care. He's attacked Hillary Clinton and John Edwards for saying that their universal health care program is mandatory. And he has talked about the Social Security crisis, that is coming, sort of quoting Republican talking points. He thinks that nuclear power should be considered part of the solution to America's energy crisis. He's the only one of the Democrats who does, and recently joined Hillary in voting for the free trade agreement with Peru. So Z Magazine says, follow the money. Obama's presidential campaign has received nearly $5 million from securities and investment firms and $866,000 from commercial banks through October of 2007. His top contributor so far is Goldman Sachs. And this is according to the Center for Responsive Politics. Goldman Sachs is a major proponent of privatizing Social Security, as well as legislation that would essentially deregulate the investment banking securities industry. Eight of Obama's top 20 election investors are securities and investment firms. And they go through the list: Goldman Sachs, Lehman Brothers, J.P. Morgan Chase, Citadel, USB, USB America, Morgan Stanley, Credit Suisse. And meanwhile, Obama's presidential run has been assisted by more than $2 million, again from Z Magazine, from the healthcare sector and nearly $400,000 from the insurance industry as of October 2007, according to the Center for Responsive Politics. His wife, Michelle, a fellow Harvard Law graduate, was until recently a vice president for community external affairs at the University of Chicago Hospitals, a position that paid her $273,618 in the year 2006. And Obama's sixth largest contributor is Exelon, the proud Chicago-based owner and operator of, of more nuclear power plants than any entity on Earth. Given this, and at the same time, again, if Barack Obama is the party's nominee, as I said about Hillary Clinton, not my first choice, but if he's the nominee, I will work to get him elected and support him. But given this, I'm sitting here scratching my head. Why would Dennis Kucinich throw his vote to Barack Obama? I don't get it. Len in New York City, your thoughts on the subject. Hey, Len, welcome to the program.
Hi, Happy New Year. Thanks for taking my call.
Thank you.
Listening to it, I've got to see Dennis Kucinich recognizes what I think a lot of people recognize. And what you just did was list all the, where all that money came from.
Right.
But money's going to go into politics. Like Edward says, if he were the winner in Iowa and New Hampshire, then money would start flowing to him.
So you think that Kucinich is just being pragmatic and he's thinking that Obama is the most electable?
And also that you can't really tell what he's going to do. He has to tiptoe.
Yeah.
I mean, he's a black.
Yeah. No, I get it, Lynn. Thanks a lot. 27 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
Congressman Dennis Kucinich is with us, one of the candidates for the Democratic presidential nomination. And we are right here on the edge of the Iowa caucuses and the New Hampshire primaries. Congressman Kucinich, first of all, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much. Great to be with you.
Thank you. Great to have you with us here again. Campaign finance reform, the problem with special interest money influencing elections and laws still seems to be pretty much in control of politics in the United States. How would you, as president, make sure that merit, rather than money, determine congressional and presidential elections?
Well, the only way to do that is to have a constitutional amendment that stops the private funding of elections. You have private funding of elections, corporate funding of elections, you have corporate and private control of the political system, public funding, public control. It's axiomatic. So I will work as president to organize a national effort for a constitutional amendment for public financing only and truly return the government to the people.
If you had a filibuster-proof majority in the Senate, would your top goal be, in this kind of broad context here of getting the information out to the people, A, free broadcast ads, B, public financing, or C, a clean money law providing only public funds in general elections?
Well, I think it has to be all of the above. Efforts have to be made at every area. I mean, you look at what we have right now, where we're told that there's been election reform, and you have these groups that are called 527 that are pumping millions of dollars into elections to try to help candidates, and you start to see that there's a connection. There's not supposed to be a connection between the candidates and the 527s, but there are connections. And so, laws are, the philosophy is that laws are made to be broken. They shouldn't be. Laws should be made to be kept. And these laws about campaign finance are not being kept. And there are people who are taking advantage of the system, and they're creating an imbalance and actually cheating the public out of an honest choice. Because there's an attempt continually to try to change the outcome of elections by interest groups weighing in to tilt in favor of one candidate or another.
Yeah, we saw this big time, I guess, 4 years ago when the Club for Growth came into Iowa, a Republican group, and ran $1 million of advertising against Howard Dean. It was like, that was surreal.
Well, listen, I mean, there's questions being raised right now in national reports on one of the campaigns in Iowa, having received a tremendous amount of money from a 527. And now, you know, people are starting to scrutinize that those transactions very carefully to see if they're legal. I mean, there's why can't people just play fair in these elections? I've been in politics for 40 years. The attempt to buy the political process and buy decisions has never been more manifest in our country's history. And it's so blatant that people think that that's normal. Well, it shouldn't be. We have to realize that if candidates are getting money from health insurance companies, we're not going to have a not-for-profit health care system. I'm the only one running who stands for a not-for-profit health care system. And of course, everyone says, well, it'll never happen because of the influence of insurance companies. We need to look at that as a leitmotif on American politics, explaining to us what's wrong with our politics, where interest groups can frustrate the health care needs of 47 million Americans who are uninsured, and 50 million Americans who are underinsured. If there was ever a case for a change in our political system with respect to campaign financing, it's this issue of health insurance, because, you know, I have a not-for-profit system I'm advocating, which will essentially put the for-profit health insurance companies out of the business of being the brokers for the health care of the American people.
Congressman Kucinich, right at this moment, if a 527, let's say a union, for example, decided to come into Iowa and spend money on ads on your behalf, my reading of the law is that if you were to pick up the phone and contact them and say, don't do that, the law quite explicitly says that you may not coordinate activities with that 527, and stopping is as much coordination as starting.
I saw John Edwards arguing that on Face the Nation.
Right.
And I think that's a bunch of baloney. Let me tell you why. Because, in his case, the 527 that is operating, according to news reports, received a massive contribution from an interest that also funded John's One America campaign. Mm-hmm. And so when you look at this, you say, of course there's connections. What are we talking about here? And I think that, I know John, he's a friend of mine, but I think he's going to be under very close scrutiny.
Well, the larger question here is how do you stop people? I mean, this is the big problem with the campaign. No, there's a big problem here with campaign finance in America, period. In England, it is against the law for anybody to spend more than £100,000 on their equivalent of our congressional races, the House of Commons. No entity, period, anywhere. The Supreme Court has ruled in Buckley versus Vallejo and in First National Bank and Bilotti and other cases, and you have campaign finance laws that essentially say, no, we have the First Amendment here, and if somebody wants to come in and say something nice about you or something bad about you, you have no control over that.
But you know what?
How do we fix that?
So cut through the bull, though. I mean, if somebody's getting money for one group, one thing you're proposing, and then that same financial resource is going into a 527, and you say, oh, I don't know anything about it, that doesn't pass the straight-face test. Now, we need public financing. That's true. We need a constitutional amendment. That's true. But, this isn't, we have to suspend our naivete here for a second and understand that these interest groups are coming in that said there's no coordination, but when you got somebody's campaign manager from a previous campaign helping to run a 527, come on. I mean, let's get real about...
No, I get it. You're upset about what's happening in the Edwards campaign.
I'm talking about, you can talk about theory. I'm talking about something that's going on right now.
Well, what's without the theory, right, you're not going to have a legislation. Well, how would you change the law, Congressman?
That what?
How would you change the law?
Enforce it. How's that sound? Enforce the laws that say that, if there's any proof of coordination, there's an obligation to investigate it.
So you're suggesting that one of your opponents has broken the law?
Pardon?
You're suggesting that one of your opponents has broken the law.
I'm suggesting that there's evidence on the face that requires a closer look. That's what I'm suggesting. It's not for me to determine if someone's broken the law. That's not my job. But you're talking about an election here where the outcome could be distorted by a group that is putting massive amounts of money in the final hours of a campaign. That's not a small matter, especially when Iowa is seen as so critical to the overall outcome of the election. And I stand not just for public financing, but I stand for an ethical approach to the system that we're working within now. And it seems that every system, you have people that are trying to figure out some lawyerly ways to beat the system so that they can gain advantage over the next guy. That might be the American way, but let me tell you something. It makes for rotten policy.
So if, in your world, if a labor union wanted to come along and spend their own money to support you, you think that that should be against the law?
I don't think 527 should exist. I think that what they do is open the door for a backdoor approach to influencing the political.
No, I understand. And John Edwards is taking the same position.
Why are you talking only about labor unions? Why? How about groups that want
to? Because labor unions tend to support Democratic candidates.
Excuse me?
Because labor unions tend to support Democratic candidates.
But
labor unions are Democratic institutions as opposed to corporations, which are not. And I'm concerned that the voice of working people, particularly through labor unions, there's a very real effort to stifle them on the part of the right. And
You want to stand up for workers, then don't vote for these trade agreements.
Yeah.
That's where it starts.
Okay.
It starts
let's move along here.
Pardon?
Let's move along to another topic, if that's all right with you. Unless you want to finish that rant.
What did you say?
I said, let's move along to another topic unless you want to finish that rant. I think we've kind of done this 527 thing to death. But
I have to tell you that the tone that you're setting here is inappropriate because this is a serious question about undue influence of money in political campaigns. And we see an object case going on in Iowa right now. And I'm not ranting. And I resent that you would say that.
I wasn't suggesting that you were ranting. That's a phrase I use in reference to myself.
Well, excuse me. You're interviewing a candidate for president of the United States who is very serious about challenging these corporate interests, and I've done so throughout my career. And so it is not a rant. It is a challenge to a system which is failing the American people.
My apologies. In that context, I had asked you specifically what you would do legally to change the structure of this thing. You said do away with 527s. My then follow-up question to you was, then if a labor union, for example, wanted to support you, how can they do that?
The current laws provide that individual unions can offer a $5,000 contribution. That's what they can do under the current laws. But beyond that, this is about mobilizing people at the grassroots level, be they members of unions or not, to vote for jobs for all and health care for all and education for all, for a cleaner environment and for peace. Because this, if we're worried about the influence of money in this election, and we ought to be, then we ought to ask, why is the money in the race? And generally, it's in there to try to discourage any kind of reforms that would be necessary for a more equitable distribution of the wealth in the society. And we're at a time in American history where the wealth is accelerating to the top through tax cuts that have gone to the rich, through our energy policy, which favor the oil companies and their hegemony, through big arms buildups and military expenditures and unnecessary wars. And I'm talking about a system that we have to work within right now, reform it as best we can by abiding by the law, and also by a constitutional amendment that essentially outlaws private influence of money in the election.
Congressman, turnouts in our elections rank us only 139th out of 170 democracies worldwide. Enactment of the 2002 Help America Vote Act seemed to help make voting more efficient, but has clearly not been adequate. What reforms would you propose to expand the franchise and deter voter suppression?
Paper balloting in all federal elections. The electronic machines have not proven to be reliable. You want to encourage people to vote, you got to give them something to vote for. That's why I've been pushing the Democratic Party for years to take a stand on behalf of a not for-profit healthcare system. If you show people they have a stake in the outcome, they'll be there. If you show young people that if they vote, they have a chance at a 2 or 4 year college education, tuition free, people will vote. Voting must connect with people's practical aspirations. If it fails to, voting fails to do that, people will not vote. And so that's why you have, despite the fact that, it's easier than ever now to vote, you have sometimes less than half the people who are eligible voting in an election. And so we have to give people a reason to vote. That's what my campaign has been about, to address people's practical aspirations for peace, for health care, for jobs. Spell it out. You know, go to their doors. That's what we're doing here in New Hampshire. We're campaigning door to door. I've got, by tomorrow we'll have over 300 people canvassing with the message of that you can have a government you can call your own.
Lobbying is another dimension of this First Amendment issue that we started out with. A recent Lobbying Reform Act reduced some abuses and disclosed earmarks. What other changes would you propose as president?
Well, I think it's right that there shouldn't be a revolving door, and I think we have to make sure that anyone who would serve in the executive branch, if they once they serve, that they can't go back to the private sector within, let's say, 3 to 4 years to use their contacts to be able to enrich themselves. But beyond that, we have to. What really makes an effective representation of the public interest is through having regulatory agencies that protect the public interest, to have the Securities and Exchange Commission protect the general public and investors, to have the Nuclear Regulatory Commission protect the consumers and the utility customers and on issues of public health and safety, to have the FAA truly protect the air traveling public, to have each and every regulatory agency look at areas that relate to the public interest instead of having those agencies end up being apologists for the industries they're supposed to regulate. And so I would say the first area of government is regulation. That's where we need it, and that's frankly what's happened in Washington in the last few years. The regulators have been taken off the beat. That's why you ended up with this subprime mortgage mess, because the Fed and the SEC didn't do its job, and the American people are paying dearly for it.
Congressman, our Constitution is being shredded by the Bush administration and the Republicans in the House and Senate, and not an insignificant number of Democrats supporting them. From signing statements to doing away with habeas corpus to just clear and direct assaults on the Fifth, Sixth, Seventh, Eighth Amendments of the Constitution with regard to things like Guantanamo and Military Commissions Act. How would you reverse these things as president?
Well, first of all, you have to start with the Patriot Act, and as the only person running for Democrat running for president actually voted against the Patriot Act, I'm in a position to send the Justice Department into federal court to take it down as being unconstitutional. But it's not just the Patriot Act. It's the Animal Enterprise Terrorism Act. It's the Homegrown Terrorism Act, which represent assaults on our democracy, to end the wiretapping and eavesdropping, and to go back into federal court to look at the issues of accountability with respect to corporations coordinating with the government to violate people's individual rights, to look at each and every area where the Constitution has been under assault, and to stop any illegal search and seizures that have been going on in any way, shape, or manner. I mean, I'm the candidate in this race who, as a Democrat, who has consistently raised these issues right from the start when the Patriot Act was passed. Other candidates advocated the Patriot Act, and they call themselves Democrats. Well, you know what? I'm the real Democrat in this race. I'm the one person who has been saying all along that our Constitution is under attack. I've been holding forums throughout New Hampshire about how we can reinstate the primacy of the Constitution of the United States.
You are, and you have been, and it's one of the reasons why I went to Kucinich for President, also DennisKucinich.us or KucinichForPresident.com, and contributed money to your campaign, and I encourage others to do the same. Dennis Kucinich, running for President for the United States in the Democratic primaries. Congressman, thanks so much for being with us this morning.
Thank you very much for the opportunity to be on. Thank you.
Listening to the Tom Hartman Program, the No Boring Zone. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
As quiet as she is now.
55 minutes past the hour. The Tom Hartman program brought to you in part by the 200,000 health and hospital workers at SEIU 1199, fighting for quality, affordable health care for all Americans. Keeping our families healthy should be a right, not a privilege. 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number. Jeff in Los Angeles. Hey, Jeff, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Thomas, meet Tim from L.A.
Yeah.
That was a great interview you did with Dennis Kucinich. Even though, you know, he got kind of like peeved about the rat bit, it just shows how emotional and how spiritual he is to run for president. And I'd like to say that you did a great job asking questions. I did a great job answering.
Well, thank you, Jeff. And I think that I shouldn't. I use the word rant reference to myself all the time for 7 years on my website, right up until about a month ago when we redesigned it. There was a section called Tom's Rants, and it was all the articles that I've written. I think of, you know, I've always used the word as a positive, and clearly Congressman Kucinich didn't know that, and that's why I apologize to him. Anyhow, Rich in Atlanta, Georgia. Hey, Rich.
Hey, how you doing, Tom?
Just great. What's up? But hey. I'll get better.
I helped Dennis get elected to his first city council seat over 35 years ago.
Oh, good on you, Rich.
And I just can't see why he would put his backing behind another corporatist like Obama when he does vote. He votes present. That's not a leader. That's a follower. You know.
Yeah. Well, it's a lot of us are scratching our heads, Rich. Thanks a lot for the call. A lot of us are scratching our heads right now. Why he would do that? And I don't know. Maybe because Edwards is getting union support and 527s are paying for it. It's 57 minutes past the hour.
You're in the Democracy Zone. Democracy with Zone. Tom Hartman. The Tom Hartman Program. The Tom Hartman Program. Tom Hartman. Defending America from the weapons of mass deception.
And welcome back. 866-303-2270, our toll-free number all across the United States. TomHartman.com if you want to drop into our live chat room. Curious about your thoughts on what's happening with the election. I think most of you pretty much know mine. Any Democrat is better than what we have right now, frankly. Number one. I mean, even Hillary Clinton has a 91% progressive record, as any conservative will tell you, in her voting. 383 days, 10 hours, 46 minutes, 6 seconds until George W. Bush leaves office. Barack Obama, in a piece that Huffington Post ran recently, I said, I think that John Edwards has the potential to be the next FDR, and Barack Obama has the potential to be the next JFK. Hillary Clinton, I think, frankly, has the potential to be the next FDR as well. If enough of us, if she's the nominee, if she's the president, if enough of us push the right way, frankly, I am far more concerned, and I realize I say this over and over again, but I think it's really important. I am far more concerned with how many of us are out there getting involved, with whether we're involved with Democracy for Action, with whether we're democracyforamerica.com. You know, there's a meetup tonight here in Portland. Of Democracy for America. These kind of things are going on all over the country. Whether we are involved, whether we are getting active, whether we're out there being on the grassroots and being on the ground or not. I mean, it's not enough just to vote. That's the bottom line. It's not enough just to vote. So anyhow, let's get into your thoughts. Evelyn in Longmont, Colorado. You like Barack Obama?
Yes, I do, and I just wanted to mention that article that you read this morning.
Mm-hmm.
That's terrible. Most of those were lied because I listen to them all the time, and I have a little senior past, so I kind of forget what the first part was. But basically, the one about Social Security, he's going to tax the upper income. That's how he's going to pay for it. He's not going to let
What I heard Barack Obama say is that Social Security is heading for bankruptcy, and it's not.
No, I just heard him the other day, and he said he was going to keep it, and that's how he's going to pay for it. Hey, I got something really important, though. I get the Nation's Magazine monthly, and your candidates' plants, I call them, from the other candidates, are calling all of the talk shows and repeating something out of the Nation's Magazine, and there's just three teeny tiny paragraphs. And they only talk about the first paragraph, and it's called the Bradley Effect. In 1982, California voters did not follow through and elect him. He thought they would. But now here's the ones they don't talk about.
You're talking about Tom Bradley?
Huh?
Tom Bradley, as I recall, the mayor of Los Angeles.
In California?
Yeah.
Well, 7 years later, the name changed to Wilder Effect. Well, he won the governorship in Virginia, so he fooled them. And Nations is predicting there will be no Obama effect, mainly because he's got the middle class behind him.
What?
That's just the middle class I put that
okay,
in.
Okay, you've lost me here, Evelyn. What does the word effect mean?
Well, the Bradley effect, it looked like a lot of white people, everybody's going to go down and vote for him. But they didn't follow through and vote for him, and he lost. And so that's why they call it, because he was black, that they promised to vote for him if they didn't. But like I say, 7 years later shows you how the country changed, the Wilder effect. They predicted the Wilder effect, but he fooled them.
With Wilder, you had an African-American who did get the white vote. With Bradley, you got an African-American who didn't.
Yeah.
And then I guess, you know, if you want to throw in a third one, look at Harold Ford Jr., you know, who was way ahead in the polls until his opponent, the Republican, ran the ads where the white girl was going, hey, Harold, call me. And, you know, all of a sudden all the white racists freak out. I think on the one hand, Evelyn, that if we underestimate the power of racism and misogyny in this country, we make a terrible mistake. On the other hand, I think that power is not a power like it was once. I think it is more of an undercurrent or something. I don't quite know what to say, how to characterize it.
Well, I think your conservatives are going to keep pushing that.
Oh, of course they are. But my point is we need to be ready for it. Rather than not talking about it, we need to be ready for it, number one. And number two, I do think that America is capable of electing an African-American president of the United States.
I think so, too, because we're such a bad state. I mean, you know.
Yeah, absolutely.
We need a change. So, anyway, that's my two cents. I won't bore you to death with it.
Thank you very much, Evelyn. I appreciate the call. It's much appreciated. Angel in South Carolina. Hey, Angel.
Well, where's Dennis Kucinich? I was real glad he was in the race until now, and I think he sounded like Nader. I mean, how can he say he's for Obama, who supports nuclear power? Obviously, he's in corporate money. I heard a speech that Edwards gave to a group in Iowa on CNN, and he's so progressive. I thought to myself, we don't even need Kucinich in the race. I mean, you know, here's a guy that's going to stand up for people against corporations is Edwards.
Yeah, I said earlier, by the way, I should correct myself, that Obama was the only candidate in favor of nuclear power. Actually, all of the Democratic candidates, except John Edwards and presumably Dennis Kucinich, are in favor of nuclear power.
Exactly.
All of the major candidates.
It takes money to run. That's the only way you can counter these nasty comments like the Swift boats or the problem that Ford had in Tennessee. If you don't have money and can't run ads, I hate to say it, but most Americans don't pay much attention to the news, and you've got to have money to run ads.
Yeah. Good point. Angel, thank you very much. Rebecca in Seattle. Hey, Rebecca.
Hi there. How are you?
I'm just great. What's up?
Okay. I'm just going to tell you how I see it. I'm not speaking for the campaign, but I think, and I support Kucinich, and I haven't had a chance to talk with him, but it's not that he does support Obama's policies. He doesn't support nuclear power. He doesn't support the corporations. But the only way to expose the hypocrisy of the Edwards campaign. Now, Clinton has been pretty much on the record for a long time on her votes, but Edwards has done a 180 on most of the issues that were the Kucinich campaign issues. So Edwards has latched onto those. He has seized those, and he has run with them. And because he has so much more money, he's been able to go into the media to buy the ads, to get all this publicity on the very same issues that were the Kucinich issues.
So you're criticizing John Edwards because there's an interesting debunking of that notion that he was a conservative senator from South Carolina.
Right.
But you're criticizing him because back 10 years ago when he was a senator, he was taking less progressive positions, and now he's more progressive, and therefore that's a bad thing?
Well, right now he's saying, and I've heard him say this, I do watch TV a little bit, he said, we have to get out of Iraq. Okay, but then people who love him and really follow him are saying, oh, but he's apologized. He said, I'm sorry, and he said it was wrong. Okay, but a million people are dead. And from that going into Iraq and the funding, he's funded the war. He voted to fund it 100% of the time. And I really think that as a trial attorney, he has mastered the art of winning people's sympathies and persuading them to connect with him emotionally. And so therefore they believe anything he says. But he is not a true progressive, I believe. And his Two Americas thing, well, I wrote a note to you about this some time ago, maybe a week ago, that he took, that title came from a book by an author. He's never given credit to that.
So, Rebecca, you believe that Barack Obama is a better candidate than John?
Well, no,
Edwards,
I think that he's the better one to for Kucinich to oppose.
I see. Okay. Well, thank you very thank you very much. I appreciate the call. Annie in Manhattan. Hey, Annie.
Yeah. Hello?
Hey, you're on the air.
It's Ellen.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Tom, I just wondered, I actually called during your interview with Dennis Kucinich, not realizing it was on Monday. It was the same interview. But I wondered, do you realize that you were laughing about that $1 million or $100 million with Howard Dean when they bought him, you know, they sort of bought him off with negative advertising? And that really upset me.
That
of yours.
I don't understand what you're saying, Annie. I mean, I was horrified by the fact that the Club for Growth came in with $1 million
so
and blew Howard
like
Dean out of the water.
Okay, so it was like a nervous laugh.
If that's what you're talking about, yeah, I've condemned that from, well, here I am laughing again. I have condemned that from day one. Eddie in Dallas, Texas. Hey, Eddie.
How are you?
Just great. We have just about a minute before the break, though.
Well, Kucinich just lost my vote. Listening to that conversation, and then whenever he said, whenever he disagreed with your word rant,
he brought up
the word, just like, basically what it came down to was, who are you to talk to me like that because I'm running for president?
Well, in his defense, I think he thought that I was attacking him.
He puts his pants on one leg at a time, just like the others.
Yeah, we all do. Eddie, thanks a lot for the call. In his defense, I think, as I said, I think he thought that I was minimizing what he was saying, and I wasn't. I was actually praising what he was saying, but nonetheless, 16 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program, where we dare to ask, is Walmart a person?
If you don't get out of this year, you're really not proving. It takes every one of us to keep the country moving. You can make it to the polls, you can get together. Don't you meet me there with love, we can make things better.
21 minutes past the hour, welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, and strange stuff going on out there in the world. It's the robots. You know those robots on the planet Xeno who are spying on us? Made to look like pigeons? You can tell they're spy robots, because whenever there's big gatherings of important people around the world, what do you find? Pigeons. Well, here it comes. Border agents at the Lewiston-Queenston Bridge found four live birds inside the pockets of a pigeon collector and his traveling companion who were trying to enter the United States from Canada on the weekend. They got busted crossing from Ontario into New York State. See, now the pigeons have taken control of some of the humans. The spokesman says the men from Uxbridge, Ontario, were asked during a secondary inspection to remove their coats. That's when he says the pigeons were found wrapped and taped from neck to tail in inside pockets. I'm telling you, there's something to be concerned about here. 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number. And Virginia in Portland, Oregon. Hey, Virginia, welcome to the program.
Morning, Tom. Listen, I think the critical issue for voters in this campaign is the fact that our economy is about to tank big time when you look at everything that's going on. And in the past when that happened, in the 30s, we very luckily got FDR, but Italy got Mussolini and Germany got Hitler.
Right.
And we need to be looking not just at positions on issues, which are important, but also fundamental personality impulses of these people in terms of, are they human-oriented or simply order-oriented? My sense about Hillary Clinton is that there is a real sort of authoritarian streak in there. That's what she projects. And I'm considerably less uncomfortable with both Obama and Edwards in that regard. My first choice is Kucinich, then Edwards, then Obama. But I think that's going to be the critical thing that happens during the next administration.
I share your thoughts and concerns, Virginia, yeah, and your preferences.
Yeah.
Although, let me add, the biggest charge that was leveled against Roosevelt, Franklin Roosevelt, during his administration, in many cases by Democrats, is that he was authoritarian. It took somebody with an absolute iron will to basically crush the corporate and right-wing powers that were seeking to, well, in one case, actually, you know, they tried to mount a coup d'etat against him.
Well, there's a difference between being forceful and attempting to accomplish what's good for most of the people and rounding people up in the middle of the night, shipping them off to detention facilities because
which
of
Franklin
the color of their skin or their religion or whatever.
Right, which Roosevelt also did.
Well, he did that with the Japanese during the war.
These were Americans, not Japanese.
I understand, and I certainly am not going to support that. I think it was a
neither am I. I'm not condemning Roosevelt out of hand. My point is that sometimes politicians will surprise us. Sometimes for the better, sometimes for the worse. But the biggest element, I think, is whether or not we're involved.
I agree with that. I agree that people have to stay involved the whole way. But I also think when you look at the entire Republican field, there's not a one of them who wouldn't lock us all up at the blink of an eye if they thought it would help.
Amen. Amen. Brilliantly said, Virginia. Thank you very much. Maria in Maine. Hey, Maria.
Hi. That's actually a perfect segue about people being involved in the process. My big concern is the 527s. I'm for them because of MoveOn.org, and I'm not sure if they're different.
Which is a 527.
Yeah, because here's the problem. When Edward said that about getting rid of the 527s, he almost lost my vote because of that, because I'm saying to myself, well, wait a minute, my whole thing is I'm also a Kucinich supporter. That's, if I were in Iowa, would probably vote for Edwards, because at the least he's talking about the fight that needs to be had. My feeling is Obama, I've read both their books, and, you know, they're both wonderful people. Obama, I think, is actually a little more sincere, but there's less fight in him. Edwards is talking the right fight. Do I believe him? I want to, because I think what he's saying is absolutely the fight we need to have, and I think he's capable of it. When you read about his trials, he certainly does his homework. But when he said that about getting rid of the 527s, I'm like, excuse me, I'm planning to help you through those 527s, because when you get into the general election, you're doing clean financing, you're going to need the money. How else do we, the people, answer, we don't get to advertise on television except through Move On? I mean, that's over a million citizens telling Move On. I'm in the town where Eli was born and raised, you know, and so I know a lot about how Move On started. And this is not some left-wing group.
Maria, I agree with you. And you've got 527s that are on the right. You know,
absolutely.
For example, the Club for Growth that came in and took down Howard Dean in Iowa.
You have free speech on only one side. That's
I agree. And yeah. And this is where my suggestion would be to say, let's outlaw 527s and say, so labor unions and MoveOn.org and the big corporations, 527s, none of them can operate. And then which levels the playing field. And then let MoveOn.org say to you and me, who are both members, mm-hmm, please send $500 to this candidate, or please send $100 to this candidate.
But how do we buy an ad?
And
how does an American person buy an ad on television?
Because the money goes to the candidate or the candidate's campaign. You can say you can give up to $2,200 to a campaign.
But what if we don't agree with all the candidates? What if we have something to say, like around Petraeus? What if the American people have something to say? If the medium, if the coin of the realm is now television, that's how we speak to each other? I believe in the Internet, but how do we say it?
Well, I think we go out and say it. I thought that we were talking about 527 supporting or defying candidates.
Right, but the 527 puts out ads and puts out television commercials.
Right.
How do we do that?
Well, we separate them from campaigns. Let me finish my thoughts on my rant on this right after the break. Okay, stick around, Maria. Thank you, Maria. 27 minutes past the hour.
Helping you win the water cooler wars. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. 34 minutes past the hour. Okay, here's, in answer to our last caller, here's what I would suggest. And I don't think this is a crazy idea. I think that this is a good, solid, serious idea. I put this forward just, you know, as a straightforward proposal. When it comes to supporting issues, frankly, I doubt that there's much that we can do about these things if it's something that's going to end up on a ballot or something like that. Although possibly. But when it comes to support, so I'm just going to set that aside for a moment. But when it comes to supporting candidates, a corporation right now can contribute, a corporation that's worth millions of dollars, or an individual who's worth millions of dollars, or billions of dollars for that matter. I mean, Michael Bloomberg can fund his own campaign. He can put $1 billion of his own money in and run for president. I find that wrong. I think that there's something just fundamentally wrong with that. And there's this ceiling right now. If I wanted to give money to Bloomberg's campaign, I'd be limited to $2,200. But he has no limits. He could put in $1 billion. So, and a corporation can put, you know, hundreds of millions or tens of millions or millions of dollars. And for that matter, so can a union or a 527 like MoveOn.org. Now, here's the thing that we have to keep in mind. Unions are democratic institutions. This is the point I was trying to make in my conversation with Dennis Kucinich. Unions are democratic institutions. So if a union says to its thousands of members, say you've got a union with 100,000 members, and let's say you also have a corporation with 100,000 employees, and the union is supporting, consideration, the union is supporting the Democrat, let's say that they're supporting Hillary Clinton, and the corporation is supporting the Republican, let's say that they're supporting Mike Huckabee, for lack of a better. Now, the corporation and the union can both give, let's say, you know, $500,000, create a 527, and run ads in support of Huckabee and Clinton. That's how it is right today. Instead, I would say both of them are limited to the exact same limit that you and I are limited to, $2,200. So now what's the alternative? What can they do? Well, now the corporation can go to its 100,000 employees and say, you know, we're the corporation and we think our interests would be well served if Mike Huckabee was elected. We encourage you to contribute $2,200 to him. And the union can go to its members and say, we're your union. And we believe that our interests are best served if you each contributed $2,200 or as much money as you can to Hillary Clinton, to use this example. And MoveOn.org can go to its 5 million members and say, you know, we're MoveOn.org and we're a membership organization, and we think that this issue or this you know, democracy is best served if each one of you was to give $100 to or $500 or $1,000 or, you know, up to $2,200 to Hillary Clinton. Now, the reason why the right and the corporations are so afraid of this kind of a change, as I'm proposing, is that most employees will not contribute money or vote the way that their employers want them to. But most union members will. Why? Not because union members are zombies who follow their leaders, but because union members are members of a democratic institution. They have elected leaders by majority vote. And so those leaders actually reflect the opinions of the majority of the members. The same with membership organizations like MoveOn.org. MoveOn.org does a great job of reflecting the opinion of the majority of its members. So when it says to its members, hey, participate in this activity, people are more inclined to do so. And what this would do is it would reveal the anti-democratic nature of some of the institutions, for example, inherited wealth and corporate power in our society, and the inherently democratic nature of some of the institutions, like some of the 527s that are membership organizations and unions in our society, and would still allow a union to have huge influence. I mean, if a union says to 100,000 members, hey, go give money to Dennis Kucinich, or go give money to John Edwards, or go give money to Hillary Clinton, or whatever it may be, if a union does that, odds are you're going to get a lot of participation. Whereas if a corporation does that and says, yeah, hey, you all should, because we're banned from giving more than $2,200, each one of you should, how many employees do you think are going to do it? I don't think it's going to be very many. So that's my proposal, is just, you know, put that cap in there. Yeah, I think I think that would work. Doug in the Bronx. Hey, Doug, what's up?
Oh, hello, Tom. Hi. Yeah, I'm shocked that Kucinich made this sort of in tacit endorsement of Obama. It seems it's based completely on enmity towards Edwards, based on, supposedly based on this bad story from the Washington Post on Sunday, and his reaction to it, of course, on Sunday morning, Face the Nation to outlaw 527 groups. I, too, as the previous caller, found that very disturbing, and it very possibly sullies me completely on Edwards, because it's a hypocrisy. What has been left out in your discussion of this so far is that, as the article said, the 527 group that supports Edwards got the money from a woman, a 97-year-old woman, a member of the Mellon family. I don't remember her name, actually, but she's a heir to the Mellon fortune, and she has given $750,000 so far to this 527 group. And then Edwards...
Yeah, the group is called Oak Springs Farms, and it's a partnership between Rachel Mellon, 96-year-old widow of Paul Mellon, and her lawyer, Alexander Folger. Springs Farms had previously, this is from the New York Times, had previously given $250,000 to Mr. Edwards' One America Committee, a 527 committee to set up to fight poverty. So this is an anti-poverty group and anti-poverty activists who are supporting Edwards.
Well, that's okay. That's interesting. I am not against outlawing 527 groups. This is the irony of what Edwards is doing here. He's reacting by saying, well, throw the whole thing out. Throw the baby out with the bathwater. I don't think it would be constitutional to outlaw them anyway. You would be constitutionally challenged. You wouldn't even get it passed. But it's obviously just a political, you know, he's just embarrassed, and he thinks he has to be embarrassed, and this is how he's reacting.
Well, the problem is, I mean, you've got, for example, Hillary Clinton is taking money from lobbyists and PACs. And presumably unions. Barack Obama has some lobbyists, you know, working on his staff. John Edwards doesn't, but he's getting support, as far as I know, but he's getting support via the unions. He has been the one who has been singled out. Now, you've got unions marching with Joe Biden. You've got unions marching with Hillary, you know, and contributing money. 527s, giving money to Joe Biden, giving money to Hillary Clinton, giving money to John Edwards. But Edwards is the one guy who gets singled out in the media for it.
Well,
why is that?
Well, wait a minute. Maybe that's true, but Kucinich is also singling him out.
I know.
And he's going with a guy who is just as bad. You know, and the worst thing about Obama, I want to say, why it would be dangerous to have him as the nominee, I think. And I'd only vote Democratic. I don't vote third party. Is because I don't think Obama would be a good candidate against many of the potential Republicans, as bad as the Republican field is. But listen to this. If it's McCain, McCain versus Obama, I'm sorry, I don't think Obama would do well. I think he would lose.
I think McCain is the strongest of all the Republican nominees, frankly, against any candidate. And when you look at the matchups where you compare a Democratic candidate versus a Republican candidate, the only one who consistently beats everybody over the last 6 months, you look at this has been done a number of times. CNN did it most recently. Is John Edwards beats any of the Democrats?
Of the Republicans, you mean?
Any of the Republicans. Thank you very much. Yeah, but you know, again, that gets us back to nuance, electability. Are we voting for somebody because they're electable?
That
or not?
Has to be part of it.
It has to be part of it, but I think that, you know, at the core, we need to be voting for the person that we think is going to make the best president.
Yeah, but I don't think any of the Republicans will be. They'll be terrible. It will be worse than we have now. It will be just as bad or worse. And you have to get it. By the way, when you're talking to Ralph Nader before, the thing with Bloomberg is ridiculous. Bloomberg is not going to run. I do not believe.
I'll bet you he does, Doug.
I don't think he will. Nader, and I'll tell you what.
And I'll bet you Nader runs, too.
Well, he might, and I hope he doesn't, but what Nader said about Bloomberg and the NYPD is absolutely correct. Bloomberg, I don't think, has been that much different from Giuliani as a mayor, but and I live here. I vote here in New York City. Bloomberg will not run, very possibly because, you know, a lot of people don't know this, but Mrs. Schumer, the wife of Senator Schumer, works in the city administration. She's one of Bloomberg's people in Bloomberg's cabinet, and I don't think Bloomberg wants to risk pissing off Democrats, because he would be a spoiler, possibly.
That's interesting. He doesn't want to upset Chuck Schumer. Well, we'll see. Doug, you know, time will tell. We will see. David in St. Paul, Minnesota. Hey, David, got about a half a minute before the break here. What's up?
Yeah, hey, Tom. I was wondering, you know, you talk about Hillary being a possibly becoming a progressive, let's say she does get the nomination or something. And I'm wondering, you know, playing devil's advocate, do you think that there's any way that a Republican, let's say McCain or something, would take on an issue like this 527 and actually become more progressive as a Republican?
Well, McCain, you know, I mean, keep in mind, it was the McCain-Feingold Campaign Reform Act. You know, John McCain, that's one of the reasons why I think John McCain is the Republican who would be the hardest to beat.
Yeah,
is because,
yeah.
Because he has been on many issues relatively moderate, relatively apolitical, shall we say, patriotic, and you know his credentials are solid as a guy who, I mean, nobody's saying, gee, John McCain, he hates America, that kind of thing, or John McCain, he's a total whack job, he's a religious nut, you know, etc. McCain is the one that, frankly, I think is going to end up the Republican nominee and is going to be the toughest to beat. But, you know, we'll see. I'm certainly not always right. 45 minutes past the hour.
Tom Hartman. Speaking the truth that multinational corporations don't want you to know. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
This is our country. We're taking it back. Red, yellow, and brown. White and black, atheist and Christian, straight and gay. This is our country, and we ain't going away.
Indeed. Welcome back. 9.5 minutes before the hour. Alan Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service on the line. Hey, Alan, welcome to the program.
Well, it's so interesting that you're playing a song about the economy right now, because very mixed signals came out today. Department of Commerce reported that construction spending rose by 0.1% in November, and they had a lot of economists had expected a decline. However, manufacturing contracted unexpectedly in December, and it fell to, however they measured, it's the manufacturing index, 47.7, down from 50.8. And they had expected an increase in that. So kind of interesting. Well, I guess we're building, but we're not manufacturing.
Interesting. Well, tragic, actually. It's. I mean, our insane trade policies, we've exported all our jobs.
Yes.
How can you have an economy if you don't make anything of value?
You know, our dearly departed staff member, David Popp, who's now working for a Republican, we were all sitting around at dinner to sort of wish him goodbye, and he was talking about the Republicans and, you know, that the economy was good. And I said, what planet are you on? We all looked at him. We ganged up on him. We said to him, David, tell us where in the universe we are going to manufacture or do something. We're 16th in the world in math and science. How are we going to upkeep on technology?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and they just, Republicans just look at you with a blank stare.
Yeah. It's interesting. Kevin Phillips' last book was on this topic about how we have crossed the threshold where historically, for over 200 years, most of the wealth in the United States was created by making things, by you know, making things of value or adding value to things. And now most of our wealth is moving money from person to person and moving money around in circles and creating debt and moving debt around. And that's not an economy. That's a disaster waiting to happen. But anyway, what else is going on?
Well, the other thing is, of course, it looks like there's some real problems this today in Afghanistan. I believe 16 or 19 people were killed there. And there were they quote-unquote captured some al-Qaeda fighters in Kabul.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Kabul is supposed to be the safe place.
Right.
So that looks like it's definitely having some problems. And the other issue, of course, is that there's a lot of talk in Washington about the FISA situation and what's going to happen when Congress comes back to session on FISA. The other thing that everybody's really focused on right now is the elections and the Iowa caucuses. Now, I have a reporter in Iowa as we speak. I will be up in New Hampshire starting tomorrow morning. And our reporter in Iowa tells me that, and actually I've also talked to somebody who is working for Clinton, somebody who's working for Richardson, somebody that's with Obama. I've sort of kept my ears to the ground on that front. And I talked to some union people, and they're saying they think Edwards is going to pull it out. Where Hillary runs into trouble is if she does not make the first two. If she comes in third, even though she's well up in New Hampshire, it's not going to, it's going to be a much harder push up the hill for her.
Yeah. And I guess, you know, I'm sounding like an Edwards partisan. I think my listeners know that he's my first choice, although I'm not endorsing anybody, and I will support whoever is the nominee. But he's the guy who has been through the process. He has been vetted. He ran for vice president of the United States along with John Kerry. I believe they won. If there was any, you know, dirt in the closet, it would have come out a long time ago. All the opposition research has been done. He's been there. He's done that. He knows. You know, you want to talk about electability. I think that's there.
Well, that and they say that he's got a sympathy vote. One of the Richardson people told me that when they're going to door to door, people either love Hillary or they hate Hillary. So that's sort of another area that you know it's one way or the other,
yeah.
And near the two shall meet. Now there's been a lot of accusations that and I originally thought with Meredith. My staffer told me about this, and I think she's going to talk to you tomorrow from Iowa, when she told me that the Hillary people had sort of tied up every truck, every van, every everything to get people to the caucuses. I thought, you know, that was just bad mouthing from one campaign. And then I got a call from actually somebody who's on the Hillary campaign and said, oh, yeah, we rented every truck, and we've been doing it for months.
Oh, man. So they've locked up all the transportation that people at the last minute might want to rent to help move people to the polls?
Exactly. You have to say they were kind of forward thinking on that one.
I guess. Well, it's not like this is the first campaign that the Clinton family has ever done.
Exactly. So they were pretty aware of that, and that is what has happened in New Hampshire. I guess if they want anything, they're going to have to bring it from out of state.
How do you see, you know, today Dennis Kucinich came out and said, or perhaps it was yesterday, came out and said that if he doesn't get the 15% threshold necessary in Iowa, he would like the people caucusing for him to caucus for Obama. With regard to the other, quote, second-tier candidates, I hate that phrase, but you know, for it is shorthand in our lexicon these days, you know, Obama and Dodd and Richardson and whatnot. Any sense of how they're – are any of them talking about suggesting to their
According to, again, my staffer there, we have not heard of any other sort of second-party endorsements.
Mm-hmm.
But that doesn't mean that at the last – you know, hours, honestly, that word won't go out.
Sure.
They obviously don't want the second party endorsements. Biden doesn't because he doesn't want to be seen as a second choice person.
Right.
He doesn't want to give people that leeway at this point. But
right.
You never know what happens 3 hours before the caucus and what's happened to their organization. The other thing I was told, again, by somebody who is in the Hillary camp, is that Obama has had... I'm sorry, that Edwards has had organization in all 99 counties in Iowa for a very long period of time.
Yeah, well, since the last election, since
right.
4 years ago. Yeah. So just a real quick question here. Joe Biden and Chris Dodd, for that matter, both of them, I think, are ideally suited to be president. I think they would both make great presidents, temperamentally, experience, everything else. How come they haven't caught fire? How come those
candidates? I have no idea. And, I mean, particularly after what Chris Dodd did the other day in terms
yeah.
of standing up with the FISA issue.
Oh, yeah. We had him on the program the next day just to thank him. I mean, it's incredible. Anyway, it's an interesting time, as they say. Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. Thank you, Ellen.
Thank you.
Have a great day. 57 minutes past the hour.
Closing the con in conservative
con.
This is the Tom Hartman Program. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Tom Hartman.
Defending America from the weapons of mass deception.
Welcome back to our third hour. We'll be getting back to your calls and the topic of politics for the day and also Mark Green's conversation with Chris Dodd a little later on in the hour. But first, there are times that you know what you know, there are times that you don't know what you know, and there are times, sometimes, when everything you think you know...
You know that you're wrong, but you fear you're right. You suspect you're out of sync. You think that you're out of your mind.
Everything you know is wrong.
As the Fireside Theater says, is it possible? David Armstrong is with us. He, along with Joseph Trento, have written a new book, America and the Islamic Bomb, The Deadly Compromise. David, welcome to the program. David.
Yes.
Hey,
thanks for having me.
Welcome to the program. I add you're the Bureau Chief of the National Security News Service in Washington, D.C., former editor of the Texas Observer. You've written for Harper's, the National Republic, the New Republic. Joe Trento, his books, Unsafe at Any Altitude and Secret History of the CIA, particularly Secret History of the CIA, I found that to be a fascinating book. IslamicBomb.org, by the way, is the website for this. Why the Islamic bomb and not the Pakistani bomb?
Well, this was a term that the Pakistanis themselves used back in the 1970s when they were first trying to develop a weapon. They used this as a term to create a sense of pan-Islamic solidarity to try to get other nations to invest in the program. Pakistan itself had the technological capability to produce a bomb, but not necessarily the funding. And they turned to Saudi Arabia, they turned to Libya, they turned to Iran and others to get that backing. And this was a concept that was developed by Benazir Bhutto's father, Ali Bhutto, Zulfikar Ali Bhutto, as a way of creating the sense of a weapon that would be at the disposal and bring respect to the Islamic world.
Now we're talking about a time period here that is what, the late 70s, early 80s?
This really started in the early 1970s, following even before India developed its own weapon, but in the time when it was in the process of doing so, when there was a great deal of fear in Pakistan that an Indian nuclear power would be a great threat to them. And they began in about 1972 to actively work on the bomb. And then, of course, after India tested its own weapon, it moved into high gear.
So you had the Nixon and Ford administrations. You had Kissinger and then actually Don Rumsfeld and Dick Cheney were, you know, very powerful in the Ford administration.
Yes.
In the following Carter administration, Brzezinski, all of them looked the other way or encouraged Pakistan and these other Islamic nations to develop a bomb because of India's perceived association with the Soviet Union.
Well, to some extent, that's correct. I mean, there was, I think that it got much more serious in that regard during the late 1970s and early, and 1980s. But even in 1976, when A.Q. Khan, the person who became most responsible for the proliferation network that we've now come to know about, was first in the process of pilfering the designs that were going to be used for Pakistan's enrichment program, the United States encouraged Pakistan, I'm sorry, the Holland to look the other way and not investigate that matter because they were intent on monitoring the program. Of course, there was an effort to not upset allies of the United States and to not draw attention to their nuclear programs, partly to offset India, partly because there was the Cold War was the dominating factor throughout all of this, and there was an effort to try to not alienate allies who might be useful in thwarting the Soviets.
Now, during Carter's presidency, Reagan was asked about the possibility of Pakistan developing a bomb. He says it's none of our business.
That's exactly right. As a candidate, when he was running for president in 1980, that was his response.
And apparently that was how he governed. I'm finding through your book, you know, references to BCCI. There are a lot of connections between BCCI and both the elder and younger George Bushes and their families, that particularly people who were on the board of Harkin Oil as well as George W. Bush. George W. Bush has said that he shut down the AQ Khan network. Did he, in fact, shut down the network? And what's the role of BCCI and, for that matter, you know, the Bush family and their extended network in the Islamic bomb?
Well, the Khan network is in a formal sense, yes, defunct. Khan is ostensibly under house arrest, and the network has in some ways been scattered to the winds. But the idea that Pakistan has stopped proliferating, procuring technology, is a fallacy. Some of the companies that were involved are still operating in Dubai and elsewhere. Many of the players in the network are on the loose. Very few of them have ever been formally brought to any kind of account for their activities. Some of them live here in the United States, others live in Europe and Asia and elsewhere.
Then why would George Bush say that he shut this thing down?
Well, it was politically convenient to do so. At the time, Libya was already looking to get out from under its pariah status. The United States needed to claim an intelligence victory, having already begun to suffer the damage from the Iraq disaster. The intelligence community wanted to be able to claim some sort of an intelligence victory. And in fact, they did provide the intelligence from very early on about what Pakistan was up to in regard to nuclear proliferation. But it was a policy decision that stretches back many, many administrations that allowed Pakistan to continue first the development and then the proliferation of the of this technology for political purposes. The United States wanted Pakistan's assistance in a variety of episodes throughout the Cold War and more recently in the War on Terror. And to acquire and to obtain that, the United States was willing to allow the proliferation activities to continue.
There are a lot of checks and balances within the United States, and frankly, in the old Soviet Union, there used to be. I'm assuming that they still exist in Russia, presumably in other nuclear powers. France, Israel, England, whatnot, where it's very difficult for one person to get control, physical control of and arm a nuclear weapon. What's the situation in Pakistan?
Well, the situation in Pakistan is, frankly, chaotic. They have improved their security over the weapons since 2001. The United States has been active in helping them to devise better means for securing the weapons. It is not nearly as robust a system as we have in this country. Their primary means of security is to keep the weapons disassembled and in various locations, secure locations, presumably. But it all comes down to one general with sort of a key around his neck at the high levels of this system that they've created, and there's a deep concern, frankly, that if Musharraf's government becomes more destabilized than it already is, if there's some kind of an uprising, that there could be a possibility of the technology falling into extremist hands. Many within Pakistan's military and within its security services are sympathetic to the Taliban and Al-Qaeda. Many were complicit in the Khan network's proliferation activities, and there are very serious concerns about the security of Pakistan's nuclear arsenal, and if a fundamentalist government were to come in, or if the country simply fell into chaos, civil war, there are concerns. The United States is in the midst of drawing up contingency plans for dealing with that situation, but the people who work in this area are convinced that we do not have the means to be able to lock down Pakistan's nuclear weapons in an emergency.
Should we be worried about that?
It's certainly something to be worried about. We hope you would certainly hope that it never comes to that, but it is something that has to be. Has
I mean,
there,
there are some folks.
It has to be recognized as a worst case scenario.
There are some folks who suggest that, well, this is really a Pakistan-India problem. That the Indians are the ones who should be freaked out about this. Others who suggest that, well, that if it got into the Middle East, if Pakistan were to proliferate into the Middle East. It would become, that region is so small that the use of nuclear weapons is almost self-defeating. Any country in that region that uses it is going to be contaminated by it. To what extent is this a really big problem versus, a country that has a nuclear bomb for the sake of prestige and India got one we got.
And security. I think it goes well beyond prestige. I mean, for
Pakistan, and security.
They have legitimate security considerations, and that's the thing that's driven this process from the very beginning. The fact that the United States was complicit in allowing this to happen, I think, is a different story. Just the fact that Pakistan may believe that it needs these weapons is not an excuse for the United States encouraging or participating in their acquiring them. As for the threat, I think that the potential is for things to spin out of control. If Pakistan devolves into real chaos, India is certainly going to look on that askance. They're going to be looking for some means of trying to secure their own safety. And if they decide to make a move, or the United States feels that it's in a better position to try to make a move to protect India's interests, to prevent India from going in, that could lead to a rather desperate situation. There are lots of ways that this can spin out of control.
Okay, we need to keep a close eye on it. America and the Islamic Bomb, the Deadly Compromise. David Armstrong and Joseph Trento. David, thanks for being with us today.
Thank you very much for having me.
IslamicBomb.org, the website. Check it out. 16 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Stick around.
Tom Hartman Program, taking back the mainstream media.
3 hours a day.
5 days a week.
We got faith-based social programs. We got a faith-based economy. We got a war on terror and a war on drugs and a war on ecology. We got a war on education called No Child Left Behind. We got a war on science and a war on truth, and pretty soon you'll find that there ain't any use of pretending. Wouldn't help you anyhow. No, did not get it on the same boat. Man, we're in the same boat now.
21 minutes past the hour. By the way, Richard Power over at his Words of Power, words-of-power.blogspot.com, has written a fascinating blog. It's called Open Letter to Senator Barack Obama. I put a link to it at the homepage of my my homepage, tomhartman.com. And I'm curious what your thoughts are on this. I'm not going to go through the whole thing. Because it could be perceived as an attack on Mr. Obama, and I'm really reluctant to wound any of the Democratic candidates at this point. That said, I think it raises some interesting questions. And so, offline, as it were, over on our blog, if you have an opportunity to get over to tomhartman.com, you can comment on the blog. I'd love to hear your thoughts on it. 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number. Isabel in Alameda, California. Hey, Isabel. Welcome.
Hi, Tom. I'm surprised to be on so quickly. I am calling to comment briefly on Kucinich backing Obama. I think politicians tend to pander. If he sees himself losing, and Obama has said he may give Schwarzenegger a position in his cabinet, maybe he would think that he would send that to Kucinich if he backed him.
Yeah. I doubt there's a quid pro quo here, but, it's...
I'm not saying that he said it to Kucinich, but yeah. Maybe Kucinich might think that.
Yeah.
My more important comment is to the Iowa voters. I think that I hope what they do is get out there and give America a chance to continue to look at all of the candidates, not just the front runners with all the money.
Mm-hmm.
I am a supporter of Edwards, I have to say that, and I think that the calls I've heard about Edwards being disingenuous are completely wrong, that he is very genuine.
Yeah, there was one single call, but perhaps from another campaign, who knows?
But I think that he was burned by the DLC badly in 2004 when Kerry backed out of his promise to have every vote counted.
Yeah, no, I agree.
And I think that he is a very genuine candidate, and I hope the voters of Iowa get out there and have an opportunity to talk to him. I've seen him on C-SPAN talking to the people in New Hampshire and Iowa.
No, this is spot on, Isabel, and let's hope that this process moves forward. Hey, Kevin, you've been waiting an hour?
Yeah.
you're not waiting anymore.
Quickly. Something's wrong. Anyway.
Yeah, she'd only been waiting an hour and a half. So what's up?
Oh, okay. You answered one of the questions about Kucinich giving an endorsement on the second ballot. But I wanted to, there's something that keeps coming up on your show, and I think it relates to the 527Cs. You talk a lot about the Florida ruling for Fox News saying they did not have to tell the truth. And I would think it would be nice if the 527Cs had some sort of accountability as far as when they run deceptive ads. And
like
also,
the Swift quote guys.
Yeah. Why doesn't something happen with that ruling with Fox News that has to do with libel or slander, whichever refers to print and news, saying that, like, no, you can't tell lies? Secondly,
let me answer your question, Kevin. The main reason why is, first of all, there's this notion of public figures are, can be slandered. It doesn't much matter. There's this weird exception carved out for people who are in the public view, which includes politicians. And secondly, the most protected form of speech that we have in the United States, and this is consistent with the views of the founders of this country, is political speech. We protect political speech when we protect no other kind of speech. I agree with you that corporate speech should be under the overview of all of us, things like advertising and marketing and things like that. But political speech, we very much try to stay away from. Even and who's going to be the arbiter of what's truthful and what's not?
Mm. I see your point. Secondly, you're often touting history, and I learned so much from your show. I wonder if you'd address Mr. McCain, who you were speaking of a minute ago, as being one of the Keating Five involved in the savings and loan scandal.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, there's. I please don't think I was endorsing John McCain. John McCain was apparently up to his eyeballs in that thing. He's not a guy that I would vote for president ever. I just think that for Republicans, for, you know, thinking back to my dad, you know, people like that, he seems to me like the kind of guy that they would be more likely to vote for. Terry in El Mirage, California. Hey, Terry, you got about a half a minute here before we got to wrap up this half hour.
Okay, yeah, I have the definition of rant, and you're safe.
Okay. What is it?
Rant is to speak in an extravagant, grandiose, pompous language. Pompous is assuming to be a statesman. We expect our statesmen to rant in a grand, pompous style.
Okay, great. Thank you
very
much.
Dennis thought you were assuming that he was not a statesman.
Yeah, I think, as I said, I think he thought that I was insulting him, and I really didn't intend to be. I use the word rant in reference to myself on a regular basis, as regular listeners to the show know, and that's why I apologize to her. So hopefully that's the end of it. 27 minutes past the hour. We're going to be back with an interview that Mark Green, the president of Air America, did with Chris Dodd. I think it's fascinating. I think you'll enjoy listening to it. Stick around. We'll be right back.
Tom Hartman. Uncommon sense from the radical middle. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And not only do you have to vote, you have to get active. Voting just ain't enough anymore. 34 minutes past the hour of the Tom Hartman Program, brought to you in part by the 200,000 health and hospital workers at SEIU 1199, fighting for quality, affordable health care for all Americans. Keeping our families healthy should be a right, not a privilege. Mark Green, the president of Air America Radio, recently interviewed Chris Dodd. It's a fascinating interview. I wanted you to hear it. Here it is.
This is Mark Green. We're delighted to be here on Air America with Senator Chris Dodd, five-term senator from Connecticut, on our democracy audit as the Democratic presidential candidates address the quiet crisis of our American democracy. Senator Dodd, no Yankees, Red Sox questions now. Is that okay?
Okay. No, but listen, I'm Red Sox through and through, Mark. You and I know this, you know. I can't stand these wimps who can't decide what team they're for.
You slipped it in. On a more substantive note,
yes, sir.
Because campaign finance... a lot of analysts think that the problem of special interest money influencing elections and laws still dominates our politics. Senator Dodd, how would you as president try to make sure that merit more than money determined congressional and presidential elections?
Well, I try and do what I've done over the years, Mark. I think in any of these questions we'll be talking about today, it's not only important to know where people stand and what they hope to do,
mm-hmm,
if nominated and elected, but also what they've done over the years. Maybe the only job in America where prior references don't seem to be required. So I'm always fascinated to hear candidates who promised to do certain things, and yet when they had an opportunity to do things, either did the wrong thing or didn't do anything. And in this case here, I've been a champion of campaign finance reform for virtually my entire life and public career. I managed the McCain-Feingold legislation on the floor of the Senate a few years ago.
Mm-hmm.
I'm an advocate of public financing. I'm a supporter of the Durbin bill. And have been in the past. I even flirted with Fritz Holling's constitutional amendment, which I rarely would do since I'm always leery about constitutional amendments.
Tell our listeners what the Durbin bill would do.
Durbin bill is supposed to create public financing for federal elections, for the House and the Senate. And of course, we've had we've had public financing for presidential elections since 1972, but obviously haven't kept up with inflation, so people are moving away from it, regretfully, in my view. Even Republicans took public financing for many years. The Durbin bill is to publicly finance elections for the Senate and the House, and I've long supported that approach for a lot of reasons. You talk about the influence that money has in politics, and certainly watching out here in Iowa and New Hampshire, when you have candidates that are spending literally $30 and $40 million in these primary and caucus states here, it's nauseating almost to watch it here. It has the daunting potential here, as it already does, of shrinking the pool of candidates who can think. Forget about the presidency. You're thinking about running for Congress. or the Senate. It has the simultaneous effect of actually turning off millions of people here who think the system is so skewed against them, they don't have anything to do with public life in our country. And so additional concerns about the influence it has on decision-making, it has the other effects here of making it almost impossible for people to really anticipate even thinking about getting in public
it's
life
called the golden,
turning people off.
It's called the golden rule of politics. He who has the gold rules.
That's right. So long moving, advocate of these changes and would be as president as well.
Moving from money to the franchise, the enactment in 2002 by the Congress of the Help America Vote Act, HAVA, helped make it, the system more efficient and fair, but America still ranks an underwhelming 139 out of 170 democracies worldwide in terms of voting turnout. Senator Dodd, as president, what reforms would you propose to go beyond HAVA and expand the franchise and deter voter suppression?
Well, I wrote HAVA. I mean, that's and at the wake of the 2000 debacle, and it was sort of what I call Marbury versus Madison. It was the initial, it was the only attempt ever been made, other than the Voting Rights Act, in the 220-year history of our country, of the federal government to say something about the conduct of federal elections. And so it was a very difficult battle. We had a Republican-controlled House, it was a 50-50 Senate in trying to draft this legislation. But we got money out to the states to finance some of the changes, because state governments and local governments, county governments, weren't investing anything at all in it. We tried to also make it accessible to the handicapped. People who are blind in this country still had to have someone walk into a voting booth with them to cast a ballot. Even though building codes require Braille on elevators, we don't require it in voting places. And, of course, we dealt with the issue of things like voter registration, where it's statewide voter registration, allowing for provisional balloting when there was an argument over whether or not you had a right to vote or not. So there wasn't. It did several things that were important, left a lot left to be done as well. I like same-day voter registration here. We ought to be able to do that in this day and age. People who want to cross the country vote by mail here ought to be allowed to do that in more places, in my view. That's up to the states in so many places. And we need to have some consistent way to finance a system here that improves the systems all the time, because, quite frankly, Mark, what you end up with is the error rates in voting, forgetting whether or not people even show up, are the highest, obviously, will not shock you, in places where the least amount is spent. The poorest counties in the country have the highest error rates in voting, participation.
Two follow-up questions quickly. The Supreme Court is now considering what's called a voter ID law from Georgia, where you have to flash a government-approved photo to show who you are before voting. And second, you have any interest in making election days a holiday, calling it Democracy Day, and let's say combining it with Veterans Day to encourage turnout?
Yeah, I think we ought to try that. I would be for experimenting with that. You get arguments on both sides. A lot of people think that people show up to vote, actually, because it's the reason why they leave work early or come a little late. If you add on a complete holiday, people wonder if you actually would get a higher turnout. But I don't know the answer to it, so we ought to try it, in my view, and see if we can get greater participation.
And on voter ID?
And on voter ID. I get very uneasy about these national identification cards. And we get into this business here in terms of privacy issues and the like, and the idea that you have to have some sort of an ID card here. It just makes me uneasy. It may exclude certain people, in my view, and requiring that everybody in the country have one. I just think I get nervous when you move in that direction.
Senator Chris Dodd, in your presidential race, you've been one of the leading voices, and on the Senate floor, against constitutional violations over the last 7 years. So a question on executive authority. President Bush seems to have adopted Richard Nixon's view that if a president does it, it's therefore not illegal. Which is not only imperial, but somewhat authoritarian. What is your view on the limits of executive authority?
Well, I was the first senator. I mean, I wish there were more Democrats who opposed the Mukasey nomination. I couldn't believe that a 14-year federal judge made the following statement in a confirmation hearing, and that is that presidents have a right to violate a federal statute, and I'm quoting him, if they're operating within their authority to keep the country safe. A first-year law student, the first week in a constitutional law class, would learn that no one, including a president, is above the law and has a right to violate constitutional statutes.
Except President Bush named him.
Yeah, this is the new attorney general. This is now the chief legal officer of the country.
At least he's complying with President Bush and Vice President Cheney's views of the Constitution.
He has their view. That's true. That he's representing that constituency well, apparently, in this approach.
Chris Dodd, if you were president and had to use military force, as we are in Iraq, as we considered against Iran, would you go to Congress first, as the Constitution requires?
Yeah, again, you have to, you know, what circumstances there are. If you're acting in emergency and so forth, the powers that are the commander in chief are such that you could do that. But clearly, if these things are going to be laid out, you should, in my view, go, because it's, otherwise you can't sustain these things, Mark. I mean, aside from the constitutional requirements here that only Congress can declare war, of course, no president has since December 7th, 1941, here. We need to get back to that track again. And obviously, this excessive grabbing, which presidents have done of both parties over the years, to empower the executive branch and watching members of Congress run for the office promising if elected they'll even diminish further the legislative branch's co-equal authority, has been very troubling of upsetting this delicate balance that the founders envisioned here, which is terribly inefficient, but they were concerned about not just what we did but how we did things. And by disrupting that balance of power, insisting upon signing statements, and I was rather floored the other day to hear leading Democrats, so-called leading Democratic candidates for the presidency, talk about the legitimacy of signing statements by American presidents. In my view, they're very, very dangerous. Presidents have a tremendous power. It's called the power to veto here. They themselves can decide to thwart the entire will of 535 members of Congress by a veto. Another Congress can override that veto. That's extraordinary power. The idea that you'd give a president the idea they could then have a signing statement to declare what congressional intent was or counter to that intent goes way beyond anything so I've read in Article 2 of the Constitution.
So there's no circumstance you think a president should do it.
I don't think so. I think that's wrong. I think it exceeds that authority. You've got a right to veto it. That's tremendous power to veto.
Mm-hmm. Given limited time, Senator Dodd, I want to ask you a question about labor democracy and church-state relations separately. Mm-hmm. President Kennedy, of course, famously said in 1960, quote, "I believe the separation between church and state is absolute." Close quote. Governor Romney, less famously but prominently last month, said that freedom requires religion, his words, and that it's good that the public weighs religious values in elections. What's closer to your point of view?
Well, look, I mean, the wonderful thing about this country is the sense of pluralism and diversity about it. And the First Amendment obviously guarantees a separation, that the state will not be run by a church, and that churches should not be denied their opportunity to practice what they want by the state. It also goes further in a sense in that it also recognizes there are people who do not believe in religion here, and people we derive our powers, as many believe, I do from a creator, but others believe in the source of that power coming from some other source other than the creator. And to me, that's the way it ought to be. And I'm informed by religion. I'm not defined by it. And I think Kathleen Kennedy Townsend, in a book she recently wrote about church-state issues, had a wonderful new image, I think. We talk about the wall between church and state and that separation. She described it as a window that you cannot open, but a window where at least you're aware of the other. And I think there's a lot of truth in that. Certainly the Social Security Act was envisioned by actually an encyclical written by the Catholic Church calling for decency in dealing with the elderly. So there was an information about social policy from a religious source. Well, I don't find that threatening at all. I think the idea that we inform each other is valuable. But the idea that you allow it to contaminate or direct or define what you're doing, that's when you cross the line, in my view.
God bless Kathleen Townsend Kennedy for changing Jefferson's metaphor from wall to window. And it's a good one. on labor democracy, you've been a labor Democrat, of course, since 1980 when you got elected, and before that. Elections in a democracy are important, but in the workplace as well. And we've plunged from 30% of the organized workforce down to 10% is now unionized.
Right.
How would you change the law and or the NLRB to make sure there's more workplace democracy?
Well, you know, Mark, it would be very interesting for those of you listening to this that might be informed. There was a speech given by the chairman of the Federal Reserve Bank, Ben Bernanke, appointed by President Bush to the chairmanship of the Federal Reserve Bank, who gave a speech in Omaha, Nebraska about a year ago, in which he identifies the exactly the point you just made, the data that shows the declining number of union households in the country and the ever-increasing income gap in a country and the declining power of the middle class in this country. There's a direct correlation. And so I believe anything we can do that would make it possible for people to exercise their rights to organize and to collectively bargain. It is a right, in my view, and it was what created the middle class. You know, the 40-hour work week and decent working conditions did not happen miraculously. Mm-hmm. It happened because people fought for them. And to the extent we're making it difficult for people to organize and collectively bargain, I think does great damage to the country. And so things like the Employee Free Choice Act here and NLRB that has members on it who are fighting on behalf of working people are critical elements in order to reverse some of these trends.
Because time is expiring, I'll just ask you to summarize. How important is the story of democracy, a government of, by, and for the people, in Lincoln's famous definition, to your personal political philosophy and the way you'd want to govern as president?
Well, it's critical. I mean, Benjamin Franklin said some 200 years ago, more than 200 years ago, that anyone who would sacrifice liberty for security deserves neither security nor liberty. And this argument today that unfortunately is gaining some credibility, even among Democrats, unfortunately, as I watch some of these votes on immunity for telephone companies and the FISA Act generally, is that somehow we have to give up liberties in order to be more secure. Nothing is more frightening to me in many ways because just the opposite is true. In fact, as you give up liberties, the more insecure, the weaker you become, in my view, not stronger. And so I feel very, very strongly about maintaining these values and principles that are now under threat. I go back, this is a long time in my DNA. I come from a family, as you know, Mark, my father at age 38 was the executive trial counsel of the Nuremberg trials. It was not a popular idea to provide a trial and give lawyers to 21 defendants who were responsible for the deaths of 55 million people, including 6 million Jews and 5 million others. But my father and Robert Jackson, Henry Stimson, Sam Rosenman, and others fought for the idea because that war was about more than property. It was about values. And if we stood for anything, it was the rule of law. And even thugs, some of the worst in recorded history, deserved a trial. And so I come from that background where these are more than just cramming sessions and briefing book positions. I care about them deeply and passionately and believe that's what ought to guide us as we move into the 21st century.
Well, if the past is prologue, as it says on the National Archives, thank you for that last answer, Senator Chris Dodd, for joining us on Air America Radio.
It's 49 minutes past the hour. That was Mark Green, the president of Air America, talking to Senator Chris Dodd. Fascinating interview. We'll be taking your calls next, 866-303-2270, TomHartmann.com. Stick around. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartmann Program, where despair is not an option. Get active.
It's coming through a hole in the air. Tiananmen Square. It's coming from the fields that this ain't exactly real, or it's real but it ain't exactly there. From the war against disorder, from the sirens night and day, from the fires of the homeless, from the ashes of the gay. Democracy is coming to the USA.
Spoken like a good Canadian, Leonard Cohen. Thank you so much. 54 minutes past the hour. Russell in Brooklyn, New York. Hey, Russell, welcome to the program.
Hello. Am I on the air?
You are on the air.
Okay. I just wanted to say that I'm calling you now from Congressman Gerald Nadler's office on Neptune Avenue in Brooklyn with a group of people who are here to insist that Congressman Nadler support the Wexler resolution to initiate proceedings of impeachment against Dick Cheney.
Okay. Hey, Russell, if I may just very quickly, the Wexler resolution doesn't call for the impeachment. It calls for hearings that could lead to the impeachment, when there's a huge difference.
Okay. Well, so far, Congressman Nadler has not signed on to it.
Yeah.
And that is what is why we're angry, because this is just like a long line of things that the Democratic Party just seems to have no spine for.
Yeah, I agree with you. This is the thing, Russell, that so amazes me. I mean, when people call up a member of Congress and say, "Hey, you got to impeach these guys right now," you know, the members of Congress tend to roll their eyes and go, "Yeah, you don't realize, you know, it's a." But on the other hand, if somebody calls up and says, "Why don't you hold hearings into whether crimes were committed that may or may not be worthy of impeachment?" That's a reasonable request, and that's what Wexler's asking for. And so good on you for hanging out in Jerry Nadler's office there, assuming that you're doing it, you know, in a way that's appropriate, reasonable, and legal, and calling his attention to it. And if you get him to change his mind, will you call us back and let us know?
Sure. Okay. Now, so far, I'll say that you know, we've been received very courteously and politely. And what we are insisting is to be able to speak with Nadler himself, and we've been refused that. The problem is that in the past, people have gone to his office and requested meetings to speak with him on this issue, and he is stonewalled. He doesn't want to speak or set up a meeting at some indefinite time in the future, and it never happens. So the people here are pretty resistant, and they are willing to risk being arrested unless something, some resolution of either we speak with him, either he comes here, or we speak with him on the phone, or something happens.
Okay, well, good luck, Russell. Good luck. It's, you know, I would frankly think, as a strategy, meeting with his chief of staff today and tomorrow and the next day, and, you know, with different people coming with you every time and showing broad support, might be a little more successful than saying, damn it, we got to talk to them. But good luck. Coming up tomorrow, conservative Joseph Ferra, World Not Daily. We're going to be talking about Ron Paul. Should be entertaining. Don't forget, my friends, democracy begins with you. Activism begins with you. It ain't enough to vote. Get out there, get active. Tag, you're it. We'll see you tomorrow.
This is the Tom Hartman Program. For exclusive audio archives and more information, visit TomHartmanRadio.com.